Welcome to the program for Friday, February 21st, 2014. It is the Federal News Countdown, the three most important federal news stories of the week. And my experts on this week's Federal News Countdown, it's kind of like an OMB reunion in here today. Dan Chenick of the IBM Center for the Business of Government is here. It's great to see you, my friend.
Great to see you, Francis.
Thank you for coming in. And Frank Reeder of the Center for Internet Security is here. And it's always great to have you also.
Always a pleasure.
We're celebrating on this week's countdown, Frank.
It's, are we?
Yes, it's a big occasion this weekend.
And what would that be?
Well, our friend here on the countdown this week is having a big birthday celebration this weekend. It's Dan
really?
Chenick's big birthday party.
Really? 30?
Yeah. Yes, 30, 31, I believe he's turning, right?
Right, 32, sorry.
I'm very sorry to get that wrong.
Happy birthday.
Happy birthday to you.
Thank you,
Francis. It was actually earlier this week, I think.
It was last week, actually.
Okay, so I saw it on Facebook, and I apologize that I've kind of gotten out of the habit of when somebody is somebody's birthday of piling on with the birthday wishes, because it seems I'm thrilled when people do it for me, but after a while I didn't even see them all, and people said, hey, did you see my happy birthday wish? And I went, I'm sorry, I missed it. So I kind of got out of the habit of doing that, and I figure if it's somebody that I wanted to say happy birthday to enough, at some point I'll run across them and say, hey, I hope you had a happy birthday, as I'm doing right now. Hope you had a happy birthday.
I did, Francis. Thank you very much.
And welcome to the show. It's great to have both of you here. We start where we always do with the third most important federal news story of the week. And Dan, in commemoration of this esteemed event, we'll start with you. Your third most important story of the week is Jack Moore's story on federalnewsradio.com. Federal managers forget everything you think you know about hiring. Tom and Emily on the Federal Drive had the Merit Systems Protection Board talking about some research that they've done that what people think they are doing well when they're hiring folks may not be it at all.
That's right. And I think it also was talking about the particularities of the federal hiring process and the steps that federal hiring managers go through, sometimes because of actual regulations, sometimes because of methods that they've just been following for many years. And the fact that in order to open up hiring to a wider cast and to get people on board more quickly, more effectively, they need to think about the qualities of the person related to the job as you would in a private company, and not so much does the person comply with the particular rules and regulations of the federal hiring process.
Mm-hmm. The couple of points here in this conversation that they had with John Ford from MSPB jumped out at me, Dan. An over-reliance on relatively simple methods like calculating years of experience or the number of training classes attended, that seems to be pretty self-evident from what you just said. But this is wild. Just one bad hire can cost agencies thousands of dollars. MSPB previously estimated it as much as three times the employee's salary. That speaks directly to where we are budget-wise and the fact that it's more important than ever to hire correctly and onboard correctly, too, is what I didn't see much discussion of in this story, to make sure that if you've gotten the right person, that you get them integrated into your agency well in order to maximize the investment that you're making.
That's right. And in a bottom line setting in a private company, you know that to retain somebody and to invest a little bit in retention, it's a huge ROI compared to the amount of money you have to spend to bring on somebody new. And that may not get reflected in a profit and loss perspective in an agency, but it does get reflected, as you say, from the budget perspective. So it's got benefits in both bringing on the right people as well as using your limited dollars effectively.
And people in the federal world, Dan, talk a lot about recruitment for agencies. I try to always add that retention element to any of those conversations for that very reason, because it's kind of the old line that people used to use in sales. It's easier to keep a customer than get a new one, and it strikes me it's the same idea with personnel.
Yeah, that's right. And the effectiveness of federal employees, especially because there's particular sets of expertise that you develop over time, it takes time to build that up. And so retention is critically important to agencies. We hear a lot about demographic shifts. We also hear a lot about agencies looking to bring in a new and younger set of employee. And things like the steps that the MSPB manager was talking about here on Fed News Radio, I think are steps that the government can take to move in the direction of a more flexible hiring process.
Jack Moore's story on federalnewsradio.com, based on a conversation with John Ford of MSPB on the federal drive with Tom Temin and Emily Kopp, is titled Federal Managers Forget Everything You Think You Know About Hiring. It's Dan Chenick's choice for the third most important federal news story of the week. Frank Reeder, your third most important story of the week is from the New York Times, and the headline is FCC Seeks a New Path on Net Neutrality Rules. Now, you would be the perfect person to give me the thumbnail of what the concept, both one side and the other side, of this net neutrality discussion means, because it's thrown around a lot, and as the people on their own sides try to describe it, each sounds very noble and good, and doesn't sound like you'd be against it. And so trying to figure out a viewpoint is very difficult. Give me a kind of a more balanced view of what this means.
Give me more credit than I probably deserve.
I can't imagine that's ever possible.
Let me think about that. The issue is essentially the role that the people who run the pipelines, if you will, if you think about the information environment as a set of pipes that run from content providers to content consumers, the role that they should be allowed to play in managing or in placing different burdens on different classes of content. The FCC initially, Jules Genachowski made this a mission of his while he chaired the FCC, issued rules that the courts found not on the merits, but in interpreting their statutory authority, exceeded the authority of the FCC. The courts have not held that it is inappropriate, but simply that the FCC's organic statutes don't give it the authority to regulate Internet providers in the manner that the FCC rule proposed to. My view, and here I don't pretend to be balanced on this at all, is that especially, and the article I think refers to this very nicely, in light of the consolidation that we're seeing, not just the recent move by Comcast to merge with Time Warner Cable, but more importantly, Comcast now owning one of the major content providers, NBC Universal, creates an information and environment in which it is even more important to examine the issue of the role of the people who run the pipeline and the extent to which they can, simply by the manner in which they set rates, influence what you see and what you don't see. And my concern as a consumer is that I'm not anxious to have the content providers have any more power, or excuse me, the pipeline owners mm-hmm. have any more power than they have now. So I was delighted to see that the FCC is looking at this issue. Ultimately, at least if I read the court's decision correctly, I think we're going to need legislation, and I'm not hopeful in the short run that we're going to see the Congress move on this issue, because the interests on both sides are, shall we say, very well financed.
And that gets right to the core of this, because all of the people involved here have such huge amounts of money at stake that they can influence the conversation in pretty much any way they choose. This story from the New York Times, Frank, says broadband players like Verizon and Time Warner Cable have spent billions of dollars upgrading their infrastructure, and they argue they should manage their networks as they like. That doesn't seem like an unreasonable thing on first blush, that, hey, we built these networks, we did it legally, we did it according to the rules and regulations, and so if we want to charge certain customers certain ways, we should be able to do that. Regulators want to prevent such deals, this story says, saying large, rich companies could have an unfair advantage. And that's a good point, too, because if I decided I had 30 maybe art film type companies, and I was going to aggregate their content and make it available to people, I couldn't compete with Netflix or Amazon or any of these other companies to distribute this material through at the high speeds that the companies would be able to charge these other companies, because Netflix and Amazon could afford any amount of money in the world if they decided they wanted to.
Right. And the point here, I think, is that while the argument that we are making the investment and therefore ought to be able to go into the market and charge what the market will bear, makes sense on its face until you look at it from another perspective, and that is whether consolidation has reached the point where a few providers, a few internet service providers have so much power that we really need a regulatory intervention, if you will, to redress the balance in the market.
A number of folks are making references to what's going on in foreign policy relative to 1914, in 2014. I wonder if we might not have the same issue with market power in 2014 that we had in 1914. Back then, it was the oil companies. There were two or three of them, and they pretty much owned the entire market. And I wonder if there might not be parallels to what we're seeing in the entertainment and media business today.
Interesting analogy. And I haven't thought about it from that perspective, but that certainly is an interesting line of thought.
Frank Reeder's third most important federal news story of the week is from the New York Times. The headline is FCC seeks a new path on net neutrality rules, and in some ways everything old is new again. You can read all these stories at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. When we come back, the second most important federal news stories of the week is selected by Frank Reeder and Dan Chenick. Back in a moment on the Federal News Countdown. Welcome back to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. The Federal News Countdown this week features the three most important federal news stories of the week, as selected by Dan Chenick and by Frank Reeder, and we're up to
number two.
And in another case of great minds think alike, gentlemen, Frank, your second most important story of the week is from NextGov. The headline is Obama's new cybersecurity guidelines lack a workforce plan. And Dan, your second most important story of the week is from FCW, and the headline is The Cyber Framework, What's Next? And I'm not surprised, I have to say, that each of you chose a cybersecurity framework story in the countdown this week. But Frank, yours, I think, is interesting because it actually folds in something that Dan and I talked about with his number three story, and that is the people piece of this, and something that we actually talked about when we talked about cybersecurity at the Affirm luncheon that I moderated yesterday. And as where do all these people come from that are supposed to do these cybersecurity jobs that the government and the companies that serve the government are going to need to make this stuff happen?
Yeah, and that's why I thought that the story that ran in NextGov was useful as a platform essentially for me to preach again, it probably at this point is becoming preachy, about the need to focus on the people side of this. Not that the workforce issues solve it all. There's an important technology component, and some of us would argue also the need for a change in the legal framework. But all of those pieces need to be moved along if we're going to have a reasonable set of protections. And the people problem really is, this goes right back to Dan's first story, a matter not just of numbers of people, but people with the requisite skills, people who can do, not talk about cybersecurity. I can talk about it. You certainly don't want me protecting your network. And the fact that...
Write that down, and I'll come back and we'll save that recording.
You've got enough to nail me with from previous broadcasts. the issue here is the fact that the framework simply doesn't talk about the workforce issue was very disturbing to those of us who think that, along with the technology and along with the legal framework, need to be addressed.
The workforce issue, I was surprised it wasn't addressed. Maybe there's a sentiment that it's already being addressed in other forms by the government at this point.
So, and in full disclosure, Frank and I are both former chairs of NIST's Security and Privacy Advisory Board, so we've had the chance over the years to talk with NIST about these elements and the importance of them. I think that to some extent the story makes reference to a major initiative that NIST has been engaged in for the last several years, the National Initiative for Cybersecurity Education, or NICE, as it's commonly referred to. And NIST may have thought that, as you've referred to, the activities ongoing in that sense were sufficient. I think the story raises a good point that the framework and any framework like this doesn't get implemented by itself. I'd like to also broaden the conversation to the point that Frank made about skills, which is in the world that we live in today and in the next 5, 10, 20 years, a cyber professional and a cybersecurity professional may become a very similar type of person. In other words, the same person who enables traffic understands the flow of traffic and what the impediments are. So I think that a focus really, and we haven't really talked a lot about this in other settings, but we want to continue to look to expand the focus, which also could help with recruitment, mm-hmm. of people to get into cyber, because it's really an interesting place to be, not just from a, we have to secure to protect against the bad guys, but from a, we really can be creative, create possibilities, and also use those same skills to prevent the bad guys from coming in.
Mm-hmm. The workforce issue is probably the most challenging element of this. The technology, it strikes me from what I heard from folks like Margie Graves at DHS yesterday and others, that they're confident that they're moving in the right direction technology-wise, that between what they're doing inside the agencies and what industry is able to help them do, that part of it they're comfortable with. They're, I wouldn't say satisfied, because you're never satisfied, but they believe they're moving in the right direction, and so this workforce issue becomes really even more critical. We've got the right stuff, we think we're going in the right way, and we just don't have enough humans to make it happen.
I think that's right, and I agree with the DHS view that we're moving in the right direction on the technology piece, with one proviso, and that is there's a difference between having an increasingly mature suite of automated cybersecurity tools and getting people to use them.
Mm-hmm.
There is a basic hygiene problem, if you will, that we still haven't, and I'm hoping the framework advances this, established what I would call a standard of due diligence that requires folks to use continuous monitoring and diagnostics and a whole bunch of other techniques, and for which there is technology support. That said, there's a class of problems for which we still need highly skilled cybersecurity professionals, and the framework, it seems to me, doesn't address it at all. The NICE initiative is trying, and I don't mean that to be cute, making good effort, but it's not obvious to me that we are influencing the quality and quantity of supply of highly skilled cybersecurity professionals in a significant way.
Well, I would certainly commend both of you, though, on the efforts that you've made. And I tell this anecdotal story. Last night I went to Gaithersburg High School 8th grade parents' night, and because my son will go there next year, and they have an academy track for information technology security at Gaithersburg High School in Maryland. And they're not the only one in Montgomery County, and certainly not the only one in the state of Maryland. It's something that the state has taken very seriously. And I recognize that my son going into 9th grade next year is not a candidate to work at a federal agency in a year, but he's a candidate to work at a federal agency in 5 years when he gets into college, or to work at a contractor or whatever. And he's feeding into a big pool of people who these folks are coming, is what I get a sense of.
Yeah, and I think NIST has been forward leaning in this, and the National Center for Cybersecurity Excellence that they opened up last year, which is in partnership with the state of Maryland. And doing things with the city of Gaithersburg and other elements in Gaithersburg is a piece of that.
Mm-hmm.
I also think that the framework, this is more than a federal conversation, because the framework is really directed primarily at critical infrastructure sectors, many of whom haven't really thought about cybersecurity as a key element of their mission. And there have been cybersecurity experts for a number of years that have come into those sectors through information sharing advisory councils, or ISACs, as we call them in the trade, and other settings like that, where it's more of a cybersecurity professional conversation. And the framework is really trying to get movement from people like your son, who don't really think about security, but think about, they do use the internet for everything, just mm-hmm. about. How do they think about security? And how do we create, as Frank said, sort of a level of due diligence that can resolve the vast majority of cyber breaches and problems are basic hygiene types of issues. There are advanced persistent threats that are very real, that come from very sophisticated actors, and we need highly skilled professionals to resolve that. And that will continue to be the case, But many of the cyber incidents that have occurred are occur because of issues just of lack of knowing.
I have one more thought on this before we take it in a different direction, and that is when he talks about a potential career in this field, he talks about it, he calls it internet safety. And I wonder if that different semantic application might not be something that makes a big difference, because he's grown up in an environment where the most important thing, not just from us as parents, but from the other parents of the kids he hangs around with, and from what his leaders in school and so on are talking about, is safety. Stay safe. Be safe doing whatever. And yet we don't call it that when we're talking to him and his peers about wanting to bring them into this. And I wonder, I don't know if one word can make a big difference, but perhaps semantics-wise, that's something to think about. I want to turn this in the time that we have left and point out something in Dan's Choice, the FCW piece that Amber Corrin wrote. Patrick Gallagher, the director of NIST, defended his agency's work, particularly against the notion that the framework is toothless because it relies on voluntary compliance. That's one thought. And that there's too much focus on NIST controls, the agency's guidelines and security publications, which account for much of its influence in the field. What that sounds like to me is that NIST is sensitive, not overly sensitive, not defensive, but sensitive to the fact that people will look at this and say, well, this is just your stuff in a more structured format, but it doesn't mean anything because nobody has to do it. I don't know that that's fair criticism necessarily, but I guess I can see where Director Gallagher wants to make sure that people understand what's going on there, Dan.
Well, there's a lot behind those statements. Mm-hmm. So last year, the administration supported comprehensive cybersecurity legislation that did not pass. And so the administration's on record as thinking that there is action that could be taken through the Congress to complement some of the market sort of market incentive type actions that the framework envisioned. In the absence of that legislation, the framework's probably about, and NIST went through an excellent process, consultation with industry. They'll be talking about this next week at the National RSA Conference in San Francisco, which is one of the big conferences of the computer security industry every year. So they've engaged in a large outreach effort with industry. But they don't have that additional legislative impetus that they would have had that legislation passed. It's unclear whether that legislation will continue. To the second point, yes, NIST has a lot of guidance. And one of the concerns is that it's hard to understand, especially as you're coming in to the cybersecurity arena as a federal actor or supporter, how do you really access that guidance? The framework, I think, is an interesting piece because it does try to take that NIST guidance and make it accessible to critical infrastructure providers who really haven't thought about how do you secure critical assets, and tries to make it a little bit more plain language.
The toothless allegation, Frank, seems to me to be a bit of a push because, or a stretch rather, because the White House took warnings from members of both parties in Congress after the cybersecurity executive order came out saying, hey, don't overstep your authority here. Leave it to us what is for us to do. And as Dan references, so far they've done nothing, but that's not the White House's fault.
Right, but if we can avoid playing the blame game, which is easy to do on this one, a couple of observations. One is, absent legislation, all we have is, if you will, hortatory guidance. That said, as Dan pointed out, NIST has issued reams of guidance. Part of the problem, and I hope this occurs in operationalizing the framework, is distinguishing that which is important from all of the rest, because there's no way that any organization has the resources necessary to follow every admonition and piece of advice that is coming out of NIST. So far, that hasn't happened. My hope is that in the next step, we will begin to see a move toward distinguishing between that which is important and that which is, shall we say, less important.
There should be plenty of opportunities for that. The story says NIST officials continue to stress the framework's just the first version of several to come. So there will be plenty of opportunity for evolution here.
Yeah, and I think there's been an evolution here for 25 years. In 1987, Frank was one of the primary authors of the Computer Security Act. I had the good fortune to help with a revision to that with FISMA in 2002 as part of the E-Government Act. And both of those statutes are premised on a risk-based protocol, where you look not at the cybersecurity picture per se, but at what is the mission of what you're trying to do? How are you using information technology and information assets to deliver on that mission? And then what are those risks? And then the NIST catalog is a way in to say, all right, if you have lots of different ways to do that, here are the things you should pick out that are the important, to Frank's point, as opposed to all the other ones that NIST puts out. So it's not a mandatory set of you have to do every one of these controls. It's important, Frank's point about you really want to focus on what matters most to the action that you're doing. And for hopefully future versions of the framework, as it increases in application, as it applies to these sectors, will continue to hone down on what's important and how do you separate that out.
Yeah, and if I may, picking up on Dan's point and your, I think, remarkably astute observation that if we stop talking about security and start talking about safety or hygiene, maybe we'll gain more purchase. And for most entities, except for those that, if you will, are special targets or immune compromised, and using the health metaphor, basic hygiene is all they need. And having simple ways to do that becomes very, very important. And my hope is that the framework will take us there.
And I would, basic hygiene is most of the time all they need. They may still need specialized help if somebody gets into their network.
Fair enough.
But I agree with the point generally.
The second most important federal news story of the week is selected by both my experts on the Federal News Countdown this week, Frank Reeder and Dan Chenick. Both stories have to do with the release of the National Cybersecurity Framework. Dan's story is from FCW, the Cyber Framework, What's Next? Frank's second most important federal news story of the week from NextGov, Obama's new cybersecurity guidelines lack a workforce plan. You can find both of them at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. We're up to the top of the charts. The most important story is selected by each of my guests next when we come back on the Federal News Countdown. Welcome back to In-Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. The Federal News Countdown this week features the three most important federal news stories of the week as selected by Frank Reeder and Dan Chenick, and we're up to
number one.
And, Dan, your most important federal news story of the week is from Defense One. It's Patrick Tucker's story. Headline, this is how America's spies could find the next national security threat. And it's about crowdsourcing predictions. And this idea of crowdsourcing and making markets and so on has been around for a while, but this appears to have a little bit of a new twist to it, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I think that it's an interesting take off on where the internet is going generally, and you're seeing more and more crowdsourced, co-produced, group-produced content on the internet. And this is trying to say, all right, we can take an idea that's been around for a while, predictive markets, and come up with ways to think about events that might be scenarios that we're preparing for as a government in terms of national security protectiveness, and try to get a sense from the market, meaning millions of people around the world, as to what the probability is of those events and what the response modes to those events could be. And it's a careful conversation because, as the article points out, you can put out the wrong example and get in a lot of trouble, especially mm-hmm. if you're in the government. But if framed in the right way, it takes advantage of mechanisms that are being used by our kids, that are being used by schools, gaming type mechanisms, collective thought, collective wisdom, and really increasing the power of analysts who already have the power of technology to assess a very large set of information resources, and increasing that power by making them able to bounce ideas off or more properly collect ideas from groups of people thinking about similar types of events.
The story references something that we don't hear very much about, too. We hear about DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Activity, Frank, on a pretty regular basis. They're talking about something cool that they're doing, or pursuing at least. This story references the National Intelligence, DNI's Intelligence Advanced Research Projects Activity, IARPA. There are a couple other of these around government.
Yeah, there's HSARPA, Homeland Security,
yes,
as well.
Yes, they have one, and I believe the Energy Department has one, too, if I'm not mistaken. But that the fact that this exists, I think, is encouraging because it means that they, in the intelligence community, are trying to get out of what is endemic in government in many cases, which is we're going to keep doing this because this is the way we've always done it.
Yeah, I mean, certainly, if they can indeed follow the intellectual model that DARPA has been using for the last 3 or 4 decades, the existence of IARPA in and of itself is encouraging. The intelligence community had at least 2 problems that became apparent after 9/11. The first being simply the compartmentalization, which is a good thing in the intelligence community unless the intelligence people don't talk to each other. And the we've always done it this way syndrome. This is a very encouraging sign, but I think is indicative of how the thinking in that community has changed radically, certainly more radically than any other bureaucracy I've seen in the last decade.
And I have a theory about why that is, Dan, and it's because of something that our friend Ron Sanders told me, and that is that half, I believe the number he gave me was half of the people working in the intelligence community today were hired after 9/11. Between workforce attrition and just the expansion of the community, there are a lot of people on the younger end of the demographic spectrum working in the intelligence community today who would be open to this kind of idea.
Yeah, I think that's right. And also the fact that this was implemented through university, through George Mason, where they have ties to and an understanding of the population that you're referring to, the younger workers, people who are in schools coming out into the workforce. I think it's a promising leveraging of, as we said, this technique that's been around for a while. And the question really is, how do you take these principles and the sort of the fun of it, if you will, the gaming fun of gaming and crowdsourcing, and then direct it into real scenarios so that you're not taking resources that might be better used to protect against particular threats and just using them for, well, let's just see what the crowd thinks, but you're directing that thinking toward the proper uses.
There's a concept that is introduced in this piece, Dan, that I want you to give me your thumbnail definition of, and that is the combinatorial space. Tell me your takeaway from this piece about what the combinatorial space is and who may occupy it.
Yeah, so I think that this is sort of bringing together it's another way of talking about crowdsourcing. The combinatorial takes multiple pockets of crowdsourcing, if you will, and looks across it. It's almost like a meta-analysis, who are listening, who are familiar with that term in statistics, instead of doing one large statistical set or one set of crowdsourcing, it's combining different forecasts together that themselves are a product of crowdsourced types of activities. And it does create, it creates for a sort of higher level of abstraction, but it creates for a larger sample size, if you will, or a larger number of people that the agency is able to take advantage of. And so long as you are careful, and the article points out a couple of examples where the agency wasn't necessarily careful after around 9/11, before and after, if you're careful about how you frame that, it can increase the analytical power and thus the benefit of that technique to the government.
It sounds like maybe an exponential version of crowdsourcing or the next layer of it, where you're actually combining stuff that you've already crowdsourced to sort through the data.
Yeah, I think that's right. And it's enabled by big data, if you will, if you think about matching the crowdsourced reference to the ability of analytics tools now to look across different data sets that themselves are the compilation of lots of different information, it really increases the power of an intelligence analyst or any other type of analyst to create value from that information.
Frank, you get the last word here. Do you have a sense that other agencies might be willing to go into this business at the expense of the we've always done it this way, so we're always going to do it this way business? And by the business, I mean the willingness to look at this concept of crowdsourcing or combinatorial space.
Yeah. At the risk of trashing myself as one who's on the other side of this, to some degree, this is a function of a generational shift.
Mm-hmm.
I think as the generation that follows mine and Dan's is increasingly in leadership position, this will come naturally. I don't think it will require some kind of deterministic approach.
the question I hear about concepts like this across government from the generation that follows us is, why don't you do that? Not why do you do whatever? And it strikes me that this might be the same issue. Dan Chenick's most important federal news story of the week is from Defense One. It is titled, "This is How America's Spies Could Find the Next National Security Threat." It's posted later today at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth, just like all of our stories on this week's Federal News Countdown. When we come back, the most important federal news story of the week, as selected by Frank Reeder, to wrap up this week's Federal News Countdown. Welcome back to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio. The Federal News Countdown this week features the three most important federal news stories of the week as selected by Dan Chenick of the IBM Center for the Business of Government and Frank Reeder of the Center for Internet Security. And Frank, your most important federal news story of the week is from the Washington Post. The headline is Department of Homeland Security Cancels National License Plate Tracking Plan. And this is actually this, I guess, kind of the second generation of this story, because this came out only a day or so after we learned about the plan to do it in the first place.
Yeah, and it will come as a great surprise to you, Francis, but I actually do read in preparation for being here. I don't make it up on the morning of the show.
You're ahead of me.
And I wasn't trying to make an invidious comparison.
That's okay.
You set yourself up for it.
That's correct.
So Secretary Johnson trumped my story when on Thursday we learned that he had pulled this plan to set up a national license plate database. The larger point here, since I can no longer trash DHS because they're doing the right thing, is that we still are in the Wild West on this whole question of surveillance, whether we're talking about policies governing the use of drones or street cameras, or in this instance, the technologies that we have that will do facial recognition or maintaining a database of license plates. We don't have, as the military would call it, rules of engagement. We don't have a clearly understood set of principles that folks can use. And we are, as a consequence, as we were in this case, in a reactive mode. Somebody puts something out. The privacy community goes crazy. Secretary Johnson says, doesn't pass the smell test, pulls it back. But we do need to have that larger conversation about how these various surveillance technologies can be deployed in a way that will provide the sorts of protections that you and I expect we will have, while at the same time respecting the fact that Big Brother or government or large institutions don't have a right to know everything we do, our whereabouts, our movements, and the like, just because they can.
I initially was not too terribly spooked by this story, I have to admit, Dan. But then I got into the story that we have about this issue on federalnewsradio.com, and I don't know if I can pull the passage up quickly, but it mentioned that the original RFI wanted not just the ability to collect the license plate, but also a pullout shot of the entire vehicle that goes with the car. I mean, they were doing some pretty hardcore data collection here.
And that goes to the point that Frank's making about the ubiquitousness of the data that are out there, and video technology, which, given increasing power of the internet and through broadband, can be easily accessed and stored in ways that you could never have dreamed about 5 years ago. And the scale of that data is potentially very valuable in to understand where the person of interest might be. But as we've seen from all of the revelations coming out of the NSA experience over the last 6 months, it takes policy judgment and proper rules of engagement to be able to use that data properly and to in ways that are respectful of the culture and beliefs that Americans have of what government does with their information, and yet retain the power of the data to do that. And so that's, I think, the point that Frank was making, that DHS in putting this out sort of illustrated that point with the story, is that here's another database that has lots of information about all of us. And there are other examples of the government doing this in other settings where the targets are probably maybe 1/10 of 1% of the actual number of images that might be captured by this database. But you need to know how to get to that 0.1%. So you need those rules to be able to talk with local law enforcement authorities, collect that information, access it, et cetera. It's very similar to the discussions that we're having in the post-NSA surveillance initiative.
Frank, we only have a minute or so left, but the thing about this story that jumped out at me that I thought just was a little odd, the solicitation was posted without the awareness of ICE leadership, according to the spokesperson, Gillian Christensen. Gillian Christensen, apologize if I mispronounced her name. But I wonder how that happened. I'm certainly not expecting you to know, but that doesn't seem that would be standard operating procedure, that something that could be this potentially controversial would get posted without somebody close to the top knowing about it.
I'm equally mystified.
That strikes me as kind of a structural issue that somebody needs to look at. Isn't that fair to say?
It's a structural issue. It's also a very big government.
Sure.
This
is a pretty big concept.
I understand. There are lots of activities, and it's a question of judging which activities merit the rise in raising things up to an executive level, which gets to Frank's point about you need rules, mm-hmm. not just rules of engagement about how you access the information, but rules of engagement about when do you raise issues for executive decision making.
Gentlemen, there's a lot more we could cover here, and it's always terrific to have both of you on the program, but we're out of time. The most important federal news story of the week is selected by Frank Reeder, is from the Washington Post. Department of Homeland Security cancels national license plate tracking plan. That story and all of the stories from the countdown are at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth later this afternoon. Frank, it's great to see you as always.
Thank you for having me.
Only 6 weeks away from the day that you and I and Dan cherish. It's your holiest day of the year.
That's well, it's kind of close with Yom Kippur, but...
Okay, but right there. That's pretty serious business. That's opening
Absolutely.
Day.
Absolutely. Pitchers and catchers are there.
They're already there. It's a great way to great to have something to think about. And I hope you have a terrific birthday celebration this weekend.
Thank you, Francis.
You can hear the entire Federal News Countdown program archive later today at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth along with those stories.